The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2019 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2019. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Hi, everybody. Can you see me over there on the left? There's one guy in a beard I can't see, and I'm going to keep my eye on you there. All right, I think we're going to have to get going here. Is the sound okay? Can everybody hear me all right? Good? All right. We're awake. It's usually right around 3 o'clock in the afternoon. You know, my whole worldview changes. All the motivation I had for the day, gone. It's just gone. But here we are. All right. Well, let's talk about beauty with beautiful people. Look at you. See, it's nice and dark in here, so your beauty has been enhanced. I'm hidden behind this curtain here. I don't want to spend too much time by way of introduction. I think everybody here is probably in the same boat. You want to beautify your schools. You want to increase the richness of the appreciation of beauty among faculty and students. But it's tough. It's hard. It's not quite like truth. Truth can have a certain concreteness to it, where you can point, you know, this is truth. Goodness has a moral component to it. You know, say like the Ten Commandments or something akin to that. So you can point to truth, you can point to goodness, but what is beauty? And how do you explain it? How do you identify it? How do you talk about it? How do you say Mozart is better than Motley Crue? Right? How do you do that? Do you say because it's more complex? So complexity is beauty? So a watch is beautiful? Machines are beautiful, right? Light can be so beautiful, and yet it's light, right? There's no radical complexity, no geometric significance, that kind of thing. So how do you do this? Beauty is a hard thing to get our heads around. So what I want to do for you is give you a primer in an hour, right? What time is it now? 3 o'clock. I'm going to try to do this as quick as I can, but we'll stop a little bit each way to make sure you kind of you've got it. You've got what beauty is. That's the goal. Everybody should be able to leave here having a strong sense of precisely what beauty is, to be able to articulate it. We need to speak the truth of beauty, right? To be able to articulate it, but then to put it into practice as well for the lives of your students. Keep in mind, beauty is something that takes some time to develop in the lives of students. I've noticed children love beauty. They're drawn to beauty. And then adolescence kicks in and they become like little golems in a cave in the lake underneath the earth, and you know, they just all the beauty just dies, and you're like, what is this thing, this 13-year-old ick? And I've seen it. I've talked about beauty with ninth graders before, and they were like, you're full of it. You don't know anything. And I'm like, I went to a music conservatory. I studied this stuff. I know, what do you know? All that kind of stuff. And I remember having the identical conversation with juniors. And this is about the objectivity of music and how Mozart is better than Motley Crue. That doesn't make Motley Crue horrible. I like heavy metal. All right. Mozart is better than Motley Crue. And we'll find out why. We'll talk about that. And the students were eating it up. And they were loving it. This one student in particular. And the joke is that what I didn't tell you is that was the same class 2 years apart. Same conversation, but they were ready for it. They weren't ready for it in ninth grade. So take your time. Be patient with this stuff. But I think you're going to, I think this is something that you'll find, especially when they hit around 11th grade, they knew truth, they knew goodness, but man, when you give them beauty, they'll say, something akin to, my theology's always missed something, and now I found it. This is it, or it found me, right? This is it, beauty. All right, so let's look at beauty. What is it? I had some extra slides I put in here that are not showing up, but that's okay, no big deal. All right, first thing with beauty is a term that I like to use called cosmic piety. It's the first thing we want to think about when we're thinking about beauty, is this term called cosmic piety. It's a term scholars use for this conception of the world that was ubiquitous throughout the ancient world, okay? Whether you were in Israel or Egypt, Eurasia, Africa, China, India. It was this notion that the world is filled with divine meaning and purpose. The world's filled with divine meaning and purpose. And therefore, every person born into the world is born into a divine obligation. We're all obliged to conform our lives into a harmonious relationship with that divine meaning and purpose. Okay? Now, that's stark contrast to the world we're living in today. The world we're living in today assumes there is no meaning or purpose in the world. And this is because we know only through scientific rationalism. And scientific rationalism reveals to us that there's only biology, chemistry, and physics, and nothing more. And any meaning that's out there is a human construct that we splash onto a meaningless world. So you ever wonder why we consider splashed paint on a white canvas art today? Well, that's our world. The world in which we live is just biology, chemistry, and physics. There is no meaning, there is no purpose, apart from that which we splash onto it. Okay? It's very important to get, because that's the air our students are breathing. So they're going to come into the classroom and say, who are you to define meaning? Who are you to define art or music? I get to splash whatever meaning I want. Does that make sense? So the first thing you want to get is this notion that the world, classically speaking, is filled with divine meaning and purpose. And therefore, it calls us into a harmonious relationship with itself. This is why cosmic piety, is so key. This is why wisdom and virtue are so important in classical education. Wisdom is the knowledge of that divine meaning and purpose, whereas virtue is learning to love and align my desires with that meaning and purpose. We'll develop that as we go along, because art and beauty are going to be mediators for those two things. Wisdom is the knowledge of that divine meaning and purpose, and virtue is aligning my loves. Augustine would call it the ordo amoris, the ordering of my loves in accordance with that divine meaning and purpose. Make sense? Get a feel for that? Okay. So how do we know this divine meaning and purpose? What is it? Well, this is where we get into beauty, and particularly in relation to the great three cosmic values of truth, goodness, and beauty, aletheia, agathos, and kalos. So to understand beauty, we relate it to these other two values. That's just an easiest way for us to conceptualize it. So by the time you get to someone like Plato, so we're talking 4th century BC, truth, goodness, and beauty were already pretty accepted philosophical categories. As a matter of fact, the Greeks would see the person who is the most upstanding citizen of the Greek city-state, the polis, they would call him kalos ka agathos, the beautiful and the good. And they even contracted it into a single term, kalokagathia, which didn't make it any easier at all, but nevertheless. But by the time you get to Plato, Plato reimagines truth, goodness, and beauty as these grand, glorious, cosmic, eternal values that actually correspond to the human soul. It's very interesting. This is a Greek version of being created in the image of God. The human person, the human soul, reflects the true, the good, and the beautiful. How so? Well, if you think about our souls, We have logical capacities, we have moral capacities, and we have emotional and aesthetic and desiring capacities. So the soul is not just facts, and the soul isn't just emotion. Right? The soul is logic, the soul is emotional, and the two come together in virtue. How does a person live, right? Show me their fruits and I'll show you that person's soul, right? Kind of idea. So the way Plato imagined the interplay between the true, the good, and the beautiful, and this, what Aristotle would call the logos, ethos, and pathos of the soul. Okay, Plato would use different terms. He would call it logos, themos, eros. Eros we'll use later. The interplay is this. Truth corresponds to my logical capacities. Goodness corresponds to my moral capacities. And beauty corresponds to my emotional and desiring capacities. Okay, so the idea is that human person is fallen. My soul's all out of whack. You know, some people who are all logical, like the, you know, Mr. Spocks of the world, but no emotion. You know, people who are all emotional, but no logic. I'm not going to name names on that one. And the idea here is you want to try to get the logical side of the soul and the emotional side of the soul lined up so that emotion, in effect, follows logic. It the desires line up with what you know, right? There's that wisdom and virtue. And how do you know it's lining up? By their fruits, their ethical lives, right? So the biblical notion of by their fruits you shall know them is a very ancient classical conception of the human person. Truth is not facts. Get that out of the way. I was just at the CNN building, and they said, facts are facts. And I said, there's nothing factual about that. But anyway, it's a total statement of faith, but we'll move on. It's CNN, what do you expect? But conspiracy news network. But sorry, I had to bring my YouTube out of here. I'm sorry. So truth is not facts. Truth is reality. Aletheia, the Greek word, is actually an alpha negative, an alpha primitive there. Aletheia. Letheia means to hide or to conceal. But when you put an a in front of it, it negates it. So a theist is one who believes in God, but an atheist, right, is one who doesn't believe in God. So aletheia, truth, is to reveal. It is to non-conceal. It's to make known. It's very interesting because we're living in a time where people say you can't know truth. And for the Greeks, that would be saying you can't know that which has been made known. It's a very odd thing. It doesn't make sense in the Greek. Aletheia is there to be known by the logos of the human person, right? Makes sense? Okay, agathos, the good, generally speaking, it's a bit ambiguous for a while, but generally speaking, it's the goal or the purpose of something. Aristotle would call it the telos. So you have a good clock if it does what? Right, tells time, right? You have a good marriage if it's fulfilling the goal, the purpose of marriage. You have a good life if you are fulfilling the goal, the purpose of life. So truth reveals reality itself, the nature of reality. And notice it first begins out there. Truth is first and foremost a state of being before it's an intellectual category, as it were, in this context. Secondly, agathos, goodness, is the purpose, the goal, the telos of this being of truth. But this is where beauty comes in. Beauty is the loveliness, it's the delightfulness, it's the radiance of the true and the good. Beauty is very much like the rays of the sun or the sweetness of honey when you taste it. You can know honey is sweet. You can know the purpose of honey, but until you taste it, do you really know honey? Right? That's the beauty. That's the deliciousness, the delectableness, the delightfulness, the loveliness, the radiance of the true and the good. So the first thing you want to catch with beauty, very important, is for something to actually beautiful, it must be true and good. That's key. That's going to be huge for us as we're developing this. In order for something to be beautiful, it's got to be true and good. Otherwise, it's not beautiful, by definition, because beauty is what? It's the radiance of the true and the good. Okay, you get the feel for that? But that's not where it stops. What beauty does is if truth is connected to my mind and if goodness is connected to my heart, as it were, my ethical life, what does beauty do? Well, for Plato, and Plato becomes very important here for the early church, for Plato, beauty awakens my eros, my love, my desire. Whatever you love, you will always find beautiful. Whatever you find beautiful, you will always love. Does that make sense? This is a Greek. This is a pagan, and he's figuring this stuff out. Fascinating stuff. Okay? Whatever you find beautiful, you love. Whatever you love, you find beautiful, radiant, wondrous, delicious, delectable. Okay? So what does that do? Well, what that does is by awakening that eros within you, beauty draws you somewhere. It's drawing you to the object of your desire. In this way, you have to think this through. It's very important because your students don't know this. In the classical world, beauty is a physics. Beauty exists out there and it's drawing things to itself. As a matter of fact, Empedocles. Empedocles named the law of attraction eros, desire moving toward, and the law of repulsion eris, which means kind of strife and moving away. So eros, beauty, these are all physics terms. Any scientists in here? Right? This is your language, okay? This is cosmology. This is ancient cosmology, and it thought of ancient cosmology, thought of the world aesthetically. Okay, so when you're drawn to something and you're moving towards something, something's pulling you. And what's pulling you is beauty. And it's using as kind of its hook, your eros, your desire. So it's leading your eros somewhere. So it's like a gravitational pull for you Star Wars fans, your tractor beam. You know, it's drawing you there. That's why we associate beauty with what word? Attraction. We're attracted to things that we find beautiful. There's no way around that. Right? Whatever you find beautiful, it captures your attention. It arrests you, even for but a moment. Make sense? So that's a good way of thinking of beauty. Beauty is the loveliness, the delightfulness, the radiance of the true and good. So it reveals truth and goodness to us. But it also awakens eros within us and therefore draws us up to the true and the good and hence aligns our loves with the divine order of things and thus fulfills our cosmic piety. Cool? Does everyone kind of get that? All right. So write that down, practice it, rehearse it, and then blow your students' minds. But then we've got a problem, don't we? And you know it right away. It all seemed so nice, didn't it? Also, it fit. The categories are great, but there's a problem. Not everything I find beautiful is good. That's true. On a moment's reflection, we'll find out that not everything that I find beautiful is good. Not everything I find beautiful is true. Not everything that I love is right. So now what? Let's go to Genesis. I love taking students because this is the first question that often comes up. So wait a minute now, but you know, not everything I love is good and beautiful. So I like taking them to the Hebrews and the Greeks because they're saying very similar things. So in Genesis, what do we get? Genesis 1 in the creation account. God creates the world and he has that refrain. And it was good. All right, there's your cosmic piety, okay? The world's filled with goodness, filled with value, it's filled with meaning, it's filled with purpose. And there's an order to it. Have you ever noticed that? When he creates man, what does he say? It's the first time he says it. And it was very good. So there's an order to that. Keep that in mind, okay? Everything is good, but it's not good in the same way. Humans are standing in between heaven and earth. We have knowledge of angels and cherubim and seraphim and a whole invisible world, and we have physical capacities and instinct and the like as that we share with animals, as it were. So we share attributes with angels and we share attributes with animals. So we're mediators of heaven and earth. That's a biblical anthropology there. So what we're doing today in secularism, by cutting ourselves off from that transcendent reality, is we're becoming brutes. We're becoming animalistic, and we're losing our humanity. Same way if we go like the Gnostics, and all we do is just think about the heavens without any physical reality whatsoever, then we're not truly human. So you have to have both. So God creates the world. He creates a good. Interestingly enough, the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation, starting around 250 BC in Alexandria, Egypt, instead of using the Greek counterpart to the Hebrew tov, good, which would be agathos, where you have, instead it uses kalos, which means beautiful. And it was beautiful. Keistin kalos. And it was beautiful. It was beautiful. So it's they drew even a deeper sort of meaning to it. But then you'll notice something. You'll notice that if there's an order to this world of meaning and purpose, then there's something that I can line up my affections with. God didn't just make me to think, and he didn't just make me to act. He also made me to feel. And I can line up my affections with the divine order of things. So God tells me, as it were, it's good to love a baby, and it's good to love a ham sandwich. But if they're both falling, and I rush to save the ham sandwich, that's not good. Now, why isn't that good? Is there anything wrong with the baby and the ham sandwich? And what's wrong? I dislodged my loves from God's economy of goods, that order of goods. Now, if you give that example to your students, you're going to have to argue with your male students for a little while. Okay, I'm just letting you know ahead of time. They will ask what kind of ham it is. Was ham on the bone? Was the baby annoying? I mean, how far is the baby falling? You know, you're going to get all that. But eventually, they'll come around and they'll say, yes, a baby is worth more than a ham sandwich. What do we see in Genesis 3? Notice the ways in which Eve's inclinations towards the forbidden fruit are described. When the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was desirable to make one wise. Catch that? Delight and desire. This isn't worldview stuff, gang. She knew the world. She had a great worldview. It's the desire. She wanted a different world. And she ate. She dislodged her affections, her loves, from God's economy of goods. And so, when God rescues Israel and he gives them the commandments, what's the greatest commandment? Thou shalt love the Lord your God. Thou shalt love rightly. Thou shalt love rightly. And notice the economy. Love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, mind, strength, and love thy neighbor as thyself. There's an economy. There's an order there. So what this means is that we can love wrongly. That's the first thing you want to show your students, because love is intimately bound up with beauty. We can love wrongly. We can have wrong desires. Our loves and desires can lead us astray, which by definition then means we can be allured by a false beauty. Does that make sense? So how do we know? What is that false beauty? Well, again, the Greeks have a very interesting parallel here. Because what happened to Adam and Eve when they went after a false beauty? Well, they eventually died. It's death. So the Greeks also have a story of the muses and the sirens. Muses are the daughters of Zeus that inspire acts of truth, goodness, and beauty and bring us life. who are the sirens? Right? Odysseus fans, who's the sirens? They use a false beauty to lure sailors to life, to their death. That's the objective test, right? The test that we can all see with our own eyes. We know a good beauty versus a false beauty in terms of one brings life and the other brings death. But the death may take a while. It may not happen right away. So there's one more test the Greeks give to us, and the Christians pick up on it because they see it as part of the common grace of God here. And that other test is what's happening internally, inside of me. You see, beauty by definition awakens love. And what is love? Don't start singing the song. I just had it in my head for a second. It's gone. Be gone. Get thee behind me. Start singing the Saturday Night Live guys. No. All right, so what is love? There it is again. Love, by its nature, always surrenders itself to the object of its attraction. It always empties itself. It humbles itself. It serves itself. So Plato's going to use the word eros. I bet you know what word the church starts to use primarily. Agape. All right. Love, agape, is awakened by kalos, beauty, the ultimate beauty, right? A paradise restored. Love, by its nature, always surrenders itself to the object of its attraction. What does false beauty awaken? False beauty does not awaken love. If it did, it would be true beauty. False beauty awakens lust. And what's lust? I don't know. I was teaching students this once. I was really into it. And I looked at them. It was really quiet. And I said, do you guys know what lust is? And they were all looking at me. And I said, I don't know why I did this. I said, I'm going to show you what lust really is. Their eyes went wide. They were like, I'm like, hey, I'm talking Plato, guys. I'm sorry. It's cool stuff. I still have a job. It's all right. No calls from parents. What is lust? If love surrenders itself to the object of its affection and its desires, what's lust? And we all know it. Lust seeks to control and dominate and manipulate the object of its attraction. Ravi Zacharias tells the story of a trial in which a lawyer was defending a publisher of pornography against anti-smut laws back in the 1970s. And so the lawyer of this pornographer, this defense lawyer, put one of the plaintiffs up in the dock, as it were, into the witness stand, and he started asking him some questions like, sir, have you ever been in an art gallery? And the fellow said, yes. Sir, have you ever paid to go into an art gallery? And the fellow said, yes. He said, sir, have you ever seen pictures of naked women in that art gallery that you paid to go in? And he said, yes. To which the lawyer asked, sir, would you please tell the ladies and gentlemen of the jury why it is that when you pay to see pictures of naked women, it's art, but when my client's clientele pays to see pictures of naked women, it's smut. It really fits with Wilson's talk today, doesn't it? Right. We're kind of in an insane world. In one way, it's not their fault. We did it to him in a way, I guess. Because this lawyer in the wisdom tradition is what we call a fool. And he's a fool in the sense that he's a moral zombie. The simple, straightforward answer that all your students and faculty should be able to answer this. Because you should, if you can't answer that, you can't teach truth, goodness, and beauty. I mean, you can teach it in practice, but not when somebody asks for an explanation. The simple, straightforward answer to this is that one nudity awakens my love and the other one awakens my lust. One attracts me, the other seduces me. One leads to life and the other ultimately to my death. Death of my marriage, death of my integrity, death of my moral life. Do you get that? I mean, we can have like sexual ethics classes in our schools and just make them aesthetic classes. Because it was all interconnected. It was all understood as perfectly interconnected because it was all part of cosmic piety. A world filled with divine meaning and purposes, calling us to conform our lives into a harmonious relationship with it. And we do so by embracing the true, the good, and the beautiful, so as to align our logos, ethos, and pathos, so we can be flourishing humans. So these are the basics of beauty in a conceptual sense. First thing we need to do to get to know is this notion of cosmic piety, right? Where wisdom and virtue become very important. Wisdom tells us what the true meaning of the world is, the divine meaning and purpose. And virtue is my love's aligning with that meaning and purpose. Secondly, beauty is a bridge between that wisdom and virtue. Beauty reveals to me truth and goodness while awakening within me a love that lines itself up with that truth and goodness. And thirdly, it draws me up to the true and the good through a self-emptying love, through a love that surrenders myself to the true and the good. Think of the traditional marriage proposal pose where the man gets on one knee and embodies this notion, I will serve you for the rest of my life, as opposed to grabbing the hair and dragging them. Right. Well, no, I'm not going to get into that. Beauty awakens a love that's willing to surrender itself to the object of its attraction, whereas false beauty awakens lust, and lust seeks to control and to dominate. One leads to life, the other leads to death. One attracts, the other seduces. Cool? There's your primer on beauty. All right. So with that, let's get into some practical ways to do it. The big thing is number 2 and 3 for us. When you're talking to your students about art, music, poetry, literature, drama, movies, okay, music, heck, your whole curriculum in many respects, okay? Now, in all respects, I'll get bold there. Your whole curriculum. We have to understand when you say, this is why we teach you what we do. It's because that curriculum, but particularly that literature, art, architecture, music, poetry, drama, all that, those are mediators. They mediate between the eternally true, good, and beautiful and the human person and the human soul. Because otherwise it's all just abstract, right? It's just all abstract. Well, this is cool theory, this is neat. This is a good rap session at 2 a.m. But where do I encounter truth, goodness, and beauty? Well, the answer is through the great canons, the canons of literature, the great books, the canons of art, the canons of music, and ultimately the canon, scripture, right? Does that make sense? These are standards that mediate over the course of centuries a particular vision of the true, the good, and the beautiful that's very Christian, okay? So my wife is from Japan, and one of the most beautiful things I love when I go to Japan is I see their paideia, their conception of the true, the good, and the beautiful, which is absolutely lovely. It's wonderful. A lot of crossover, interestingly enough, with the Christian tradition. But we have a distinctively Christian vision of the true, the good, and beautiful that come through our books, through our art, our music, our poetry, our science, our mathematics, our gymnastiki, our gymnastics. Sorry, I'm looking at our gym teacher there. We were talking about gymnastiki. That'll be another one. We'll have to talk about that sometime. The beauty of gym sports. All of those things are done because they mediate the true, the good, and the beautiful to the human person and thus draw us up into eternal life. That's the idea. And then, of course, Christ is the Logos, the one in whom all things hold together. So that whole canon is brought together in Christ. Colossians 1, 15 to 21, right? He is the one in whom all things cohere. The second one is to remember that beauty is both objective and subjective. Don't do what I did, when I first discovered all this stuff, I was like, beauty's totally objective and you're just a bunch of rats and you don't know the difference between what's truly beauty. No, no, careful. Beauty has a subjective element. It's the love that gets awakened in the person. That's the subject. That's me. I'm the one loving, right? But I'm loving something that's out there, and that's the objective. So keep that in mind. In our culture today, it's all subjective. Beauty is in the eye of the, right? There is no beauty out there. It's all here, right? So what you want to do is you want to think about and open up the objective side of beauty and then reconnect it to a subjective element. Makes sense? So that's important to keep in mind, because otherwise we couldn't form virtue. Virtue requires a subject, a person, individual loves. All right, let me get into trouble a little bit here. Let's talk about music. Oh man, I hate this conversation. All right. We have to remember that, and these are all practical things. I'm sorry, I had another slide here that would have given you some of this information, broken it down, but it's relatively pretty easy. You have to remember the ancients think of music very, 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 very differently than we do. We tend to think of music as something that's composed, practiced, played, performed. That's not how they thought of music. Music, I brought in my scientists for the physics of beauty. I'll bring in my mathematicians, right? Music was a mathematics. Okay, for the ancients, music was a mathematics. You guys know your quadrivium, right? Your trivium and your quadrivium. We're hyper-trivium people, grammar, dialectic, rhetoric. But we also have what? Arithmetic, geometry, music. Music is with the engineers. What's that? Right? And cosmology, right? Some kind of astronomy and the like. Music was a mathematics. And mathematics were the patterns of perfection upon which the entire cosmos is modeled. Now, the interesting thing is the ancients recognized you can't see numbers. I mean, we have squiggly little symbols, you know, and like, you know, equal signs and greater than signs. Those are, and you know, whatever, these Arabic symbols. Remember, back in the day, they were letters, right? Roman numerals are what? They're letters. So it was a code. That's why it was so considered so mystical. It was a different form of revelation. Okay, so you were getting a language, as it were. You can't see numbers. We've never seen the number one, right? But we can hear them. We can hear numbers in the frequencies of pitches, in the ratios of intervallic relationships, right? Perfect fourths, fifths, octaves, and the like. And so when we sing, we are actually embodying the patterns of perfection upon which the entire cosmos is modeled, and hence realizing cosmic piety in its most harmonious sense. I know that's a little deep. Think about it. Chew on it, right? It's called the music of the spheres. You guys all know Pythagoras, right? From the Pythagorean theorem, so you can make roofs. But Pythagoras, above all, heard his mathematics sonically. He heard their frequencies, their vibrations, and the ratios, and the like. As a matter of fact, our whole major scale is based on a mathematical formula that he had, the tetractys, if I recall. It kind of looks like something you would find in Cracker Barrel. It's a triangle with 10 dots on there. I never could do that thing on Cracker Barrel. It drives me crazy. Now, with that in mind, music then, we have to understand, music then, in the classical sense, revealed truth, goodness, and beauty. And it revealed truth, goodness, and beauty so as to draw us closer to the truth, good, and beautiful. Are we naturally prone toward the true, good, and beautiful? Genesis 3, not necessarily. Nope. So it takes some time. There's a cultivating process. So this is where I'm going to get in trouble. You ready? You want to get really controversial? Stop teaching your kids pop music. There you go. All right. Very good. Let's go. Let's get out of here. Stop teaching your kids Diddy. I'm not talking about so much the, you know, K to 4 or 5. We can let him do that. Now, I'm talking about the older kids. I'm talking 6 to to 12 or so, stop teaching them ditties. The church is no help to us at all here. Okay, no help whatsoever. Do not look to the church for help. It will give you none. Okay, unless you find, I don't know, some extraordinary choir. Now, the reason why I'm saying this is because the different, and I wrote a book on this. All right, I'll plug it. It's right out there. It's right out there. It's called Classical versus Pop Music. Okay? And classical versus pop music explores the difference between the two. The classical conception of music focused on form. Okay? Classical conception of music focused on form, the divine meaning and purpose that's out there. Okay? And that's why you can't go to a Juilliard, you know, competition or audition and just start improvising on Mozart. Yeah, well, this is just the way I felt. I think he needed a little blues twist there. You're not going to last long. And you're not going to last long because the whole point of Mozart is the form. And you start messing with that, you kill Mozart. The difference between that and pop music is all about moving the body. Now, that's not bad. Do not think I'm an elitist up here. Like I said, I was a guitar player. I had friends that went off and played in some big bands. It's never left me. My daughter came home from college the other night, couple of weeks back, and she's like, hey, Dad, check out this new heavy metal band I found. And we were like, yeah, and we were having a great time. I'm not an elitist in that sense. But over my dead body, will you tell me that Metallica is just as good as Bach over my dead body? And the reason is because we have an economy. We have a baby and a ham sandwich. They are both good, but darn it, they're not the same. Does that make sense? Right? One music is thoroughly appropriate for the wedding ceremony, and the other music is thoroughly appropriate for the party afterward. We're not going to play Gregorian chant at a party. We're not going to play Lady Gaga when you're coming down the aisle. Because they're two different things, right? It makes sense? So pop music, by its nature, appeals to the body. If it's a pop tune and my body don't move, it ain't good. If it's metal, I'd better be doing my head up and down. If it's John Denver, I'd better be singing along. If it's anything else, I've got to tap my foot, I got to move, or just full out dance, which I will not do for you, I promise. Okay, I know you have to sleep at night. So. That's why you can mess with pop music. You know the Beatles, I Get By With a Little Help From My Friends? Do you know, is it Joe Cocker's version, right, Wonder Years? He changes the time signature and he slows it down and it works. Because it's meant to appeal to the body. So you have a lot more freedom to mess around with things. But you can't do that with Mozart, or else you'll kill Mozart. You can't do that with Bach, or else you'll kill Bach. Does that make sense? You get the feel for that? So what's the difference? One reveals that moral order in this world. That's the classical. That's what it's for. That's our Western tradition. The other one appeals to the body to kind of hang out and have fun. Nothing wrong with it, but there ain't nothing to teach. If I got to explain to you why a pop song is good, it ain't good. It's like trying to explain to you a joke. It's not funny. There's nothing to teach by definition. It's supposed to make your body move without you even thinking about it. Now, you can get deeper into it. Don't think of these as two, like, separate categories, okay? It's much more of a spectrum, okay? It's more of a spectrum. So you have crossover. I know of a, for example, heavy metal guitarist who plays with an orchestra. You'll have crossover, no question. So these aren't hard categories. But what you've got to understand is that there is nothing to teach when it comes, generally speaking, to our ditties that we sing on Sunday morning. There's nothing to teach. But we couldn't even scratch the surface with Bach. Yeah? Let's see if I can get a, if this will go on. What does it say there? I can't read. What did I do? Oh, my, it's my, look at that, my glass in my hand. Cannot locate the internet, sir. Oh, okay, I was going to play you an example of our students singing. To drive it home, but alas. What we do, and what I know a lot of schools are doing, is we teach four-part harmony, teach it very early, so that it can have access to our musical traditions, starting around 8th and 9th century, because that's when we get what's called polyphony coming in. And what the students do is we sing psalms, sing from the Psalter book, hymns. They learn their four-part harmonies. You should hear Christmas tunes. They're beautiful when it comes to Christmas season. And what the students then learn to do is they learn a music that at first they did not like. You have to train those affections, right? But over time, they fell in love with. And they fell in love with not so much even music, but the truth and the goodness and the moral order that that music is communicating to us. The music of Bach never has to end. That's one of Bach's most amazing attributes. If you listen to a piece of Bach, think about that. Could this piece go on forever? And the answer is yes, because of his mathematical genius. The piece could go on and on and on and do another. The Goldberg variations, I forget how many variations there are altogether. Maybe a pianist knows. Say there's 30 variations. Could he have done 35? Could he have done 100? No problem. Could have done 1,000, no problem. He could go on forever. And therefore, when I listen to the music of Bach, I'm encountering a sonic icon of eternity. That is not Britney Spears. Mercifully, Britney Spears' music has to end. Because the form is such that it comes to an end around 3 minutes and 30 seconds, and then you go to the next tune and the next song. Does that make Britney Spears bad? No, it just makes her a ham sandwich. That's all it does. It's cool. It's great. I like ham sandwiches. It's great. But it's not. It's not a baby. It's not eternity. Does that make sense? Get a feel for that? Now, I've taught 9th graders that, and they were like, bah, you know. But by the time they hit 11th, 12th grade, they soak this up so much. And they'll say, so I don't have to get rid of my heavy metal? No. If anything, I'll add some songs for you. No problem. But your heavy metal is not the same thing as this divine hierarchy of goods. Bach is up there, and he's meant to be. That's what he's for. God gave him to us for that. Don't squander that. Okay? And then go ahead and enjoy your other stuff. Does that make sense? You get a feel for that? So it's not as controversial as it seems, but you gotta work through it. But I just keep reminding him, when all is said and done, when you're arguing that all music's the same, you just smuggled in relativism through the back door. That's all you did. Nothing more. All right, so these are some examples. You want to just take a picture of how we allocate music throughout the day. And I can tell you, our alumni come back, and when they visit, they don't want to necessarily have, some do. Some my more nerdy students want to have theological chats and all that sort of stuff. But pretty much everybody else says, so can we sing? That's what they want to do. We start class singing. Augustine said a prayer sung is two set, for 10 set, I forget which one it is. So we tend to start class in prayer. I got trained in music, so it's a little easier for me with the four-part harmony. You can learn it on YouTube. It's easy. It's not that bad. Learn it with the students. Try simple tunes and move out there. But don't, really make an effort to bring four-part harmony and majestic music, classical music, into the lives of your students. Okay, they're going to hunger for it, and they complain. They complain that they don't get that in their places of worship. And I just tell them, hey man, relax, it's all right. You'll get there. All right. Second thing, let's look at gazing. This is a method of understanding the visual, sanctifying the sight, where we're trying to line up the eyes and the intellect, so that the soul and sight are aligned together. We tend to be very cursory in the way we experience the world. I do a lot of YouTube, and one of the things that I get critiqued for is that I generally talk straight through like in a 10-minute segment without any kind of like angle shifts, you know, and like different camera scene shifts. And I kid you not, I was just told by a YouTube expert, yeah, the brain needs you to shift about every 4 seconds. Got a new angle, and then the brain goes, oh, something new. And I'm like, yeah, man, I don't know, that's just not my gig, you know. And that's not my gig because one of the things I try to teach my students is to prolong their gaze, and art does that. That's what art does. Art teaches us to prolong our gaze, our attention, and sanctify sight and soul together. That's gazing. This is Rublev's Trinity, the Hospitality of Abraham. I have to describe it from here, but one of the things you want to do, and I'm just going to plug all day long. I have another book called Gazing out there on the Scola table outside. That's right next to the classical versus pop music, which is next to other books, and you go grab them. But what you want to do is you want to learn some ways of being able to read a painting. Paintings, remember the term is iconography. Graphos means to write. It's the writing of a picture in front of you. So they're telling a story, and they tell the story through shapes and colors and angles and interaction. And here Rublev, he's doing this in the 15th century. It's a very, very famous painting. Let's see. Do you see my mouse if I do that? Ah, bummer. Okay. All right. So I'll try to talk through a bit for you, but here's what I would do with my students. I have them look at this, and I say, well, just tell me what stands out for you. And again, in the gazing book, I created it almost like a catechism. I gave you the questions to ask, and then I give you the sneaky answers so you don't have to look like, okay. But I asked the students, what do you think? Most of them notice right away that the three angels look the same. They all have their same height and same facial features. And I said, very good. What do you think Rublev's trying to say there? And they kind of start to get it. Maybe, are they like the same being kind of thing? Maybe so. And they kind of look, well, one's got his head tilted to the other two, and the other two got his head tilted to him. And is that one maybe like representing like an angelic manifestation of the Father or something? Yeah, and then the Son and the Holy Spirit kind of, you know, begotten, proceeding. But then I also give them some color schemes that'll help them out. In the Christian tradition, red and blue represent Christ. So red is the color of love, and blue is the color of eternity. And what's interesting here is Christ's clothing has a pattern. The red is always inside the blue. The blue wraps around Christ. Okay? There's different interpretations as to why. You don't have to know. It's okay. But it'll help you kind of develop the painting. The general one is Christ is eternally love and then surrounds himself with the blueness of baptism and the cosmos and the like, and takes on the life of the world kind of thing. Also, interestingly enough, red and blue make purple. You could share the gospel with Christ's, right, the garment of shame in his crucifixion, right? His eternal love is saving us. Also, the Pentecost colors in the Eastern Russian tradition are green. So we could see Christ in the center and a representation of the Holy Spirit. But notice, too, how he uses shape. Can you see, for example, a triangle right at the center? From the sun's, the top of his head going to the left and then to the right and then straight across the table. You see that triangle? Does everyone know that the triangle tends to be a symbol of the Trinity? Okay. Can you see a circle go from the top of, say, Christ's head, then cross to the Father in that translucent clothing, follow his body, move around his legs, feet, back up around the Holy Spirit? Can you see that circle? Well, that means eternity. This is the eternal Trinity. But he makes an amazing shape right at the center. In the center is a four-cornered table. Four is a cosmic number. Do you guys know Earth, Air, Fire, and Water? You Avatar fans, right? So four tends to be your cosmic. So the quintessence of things is what holds the four together. The Logos was the whole notion, right? In the beginning was the Logos was God, John 1:1. The Logos was the Greek solution to what holds the four elements together. Okay? So that table would represent the world, the cosmos. There's a sacrificial lamb in the center. It was like the book of Revelation. You notice, too, that the Christ figure has two fingers like that. That tends to be a symbol of the incarnation. Okay. So you learn all these things. You learn how to unpack this, but then something else is kind of cool. Who can see this? I'll try to describe it for you, because I'm going to be too vertically challenged to reach up there. If you go from, say, the green garment from the foot and just slowly follow up the shape to his hand and up to his shoulder and do the same thing with the father on your left, start as his foot, you know, kind of this pink garment he has, follow it up, go all the way up. Do you see a shape emerge? Somebody saw it. I saw you do that. You did that. What is that? It's a chalice. It's a communion chalice. Do you see it right in the center? Isn't that cool? And notice it's a four-cornered table with three people around it. One on the left, one on the right, one on behind. So there's one spot on that table where there's nobody there. Who do you think's being invited to that spot? So this painting is inviting us into communion with the Trinity. So that's what you can do. You spend an entire class just looking at stuff like that. Even one of my favorite paintings, you probably all know, the School of Athens, Raphael. If you know kind of the color codes, it does help you to read this painting, because who's at the center? Do you guys know who's at the center? That is Plato and that is Aristotle. Plato is pointing up because it says all knowledge begins up in heaven, up in the world of the forms, the true, the good, and the beautiful. You notice what Aristotle's doing. Aristotle's arguing with him. He says, nope, I'm a good scientist. All knowledge begins below. All knowledge begins here. And that was the debate. That was the argument throughout the pagan world, the classical Hellenistic world. So on Plato's side, those are all the idealists. Those are all who would agree with him. And then on Aristotle's side, those are all the realists who would say, nope, knowledge begins down here below. Does it begin above or does it begin below? What's that answer? Well, Raphael gives it to us. Who remembers the color schemes? Did you catch it? Who remembers the color schemes? Who wears red with blue overlap? The one who brought heaven and earth together. So Christ is the answer to Plato and Aristotle. Isn't that cool? Do you see how Aristotle's slightly over Plato, overlapping? And then what that does is now look where they are. We thought they were an Athenian court, right? Well, there's nothing Athenian about this, because these are Roman arches. Athens didn't have arches. They didn't have cement. And if you look at the ceiling, it's exactly the same as the Vatican, St. Peter's Basilica. Where do you think this painting is? Just say the Vatican and St. Peter's Basilica. We don't have time. And then you notice it goes all the way back into the blue sky, three showings of it. It comes forward towards the reader, and then it goes out to the right, and it goes out to the left. And what shape is that? So there's the solution that they've all been looking for. So you get students to do this. I've had the beginning of class, and the students have come in, and the very first thing they say, can we read another painting? Can we do some more gazing? And I say, no. All right, very quickly, because we only have a couple of minutes. There is a very good book, but it's very long, and it's a little creepy. He's got a lot of very liberal assumptions, but by a fellow by the name of Peter McLaren. It's called The Ritual of Schooling, and you don't have to go through the book, but he does have a really neat concept that he calls the hidden curriculum. And the hidden curriculum is the hidden messages our school arrangements, our spatial arrangements, send to students. So for example, if all our walls are just bare walls and white, we're obviously telling them art is not that important. If music is relegated solely to choir class and nothing else, well then obviously music is specialized. It doesn't have anything to do with me. These are the hidden curriculum ideas. This is my classroom back in Delaware. You walk in and basically, and I was very intentional on how I arranged the space. And if you look at it, there's paintings. Most interior design has a focal point of some kind that everything is pointing towards. So you see my rug is pointing towards the whiteboard. The lectern is coming out of the whiteboard. The tables are all assorted around. When you see these tables, what do you think of? What is this room for? What's the purpose of it? Discussion, right? Because what do you do around a table? Now, this, don't be dogmatic about this. I'm not. It's just, again, for me, it works. The chairs are very comfortable. I made sure of that. The rug also gives a sense of comfort. I do tend to let my students eat in class. I hope my headmaster's not here. I do tend to let my students eat in class because it facilitates discussion. And it's in the discussions, the lectio, the dialogos, that their lives change. It's not so much, you know, I don't know, the homework that I gave them or anything like that. It's in our discussions and in the trust that we build as teacher and as disciples, as it were. These are the hidden messages. And you'll notice, what kind of discussions do we have here? Do we talk about Justin Bieber? Actually, we do. We do. But in the context of what would Plato say, right? So the hidden message that's coming out, or several messages that are coming out from this, are that this is a place of learning. This is a place of study. But it's also a place of conversation. You can talk here. You can learn here, and so you can thrive in the true, the good, and the beautiful. All right, there's a lot more. I have another book called Beauty Matters, and you can check that book out if you want more ways of applying beauty into everything, your curriculum, into your school uniforms and the like. I just want to end with one of my favorite quotes from the British art critic John Ruskin. The entire object of true education is to make people not merely do the right things, but enjoy the right things. Not merely industrious, but to love industry. Not merely learned, but to love knowledge. Not merely pure, but to love purity. Not merely just, but to hunger and thirst after justice. So that's why beauty matters. Thank you very much.